Lincoln Inspired is more than just an arts festival, more than a literary festival, more than a whole set of lifestyle opportunities, and more than what the world has needed for millennia.
To see just how much more Lincoln Inspired can make you, go to lincolninspired.co.uk and explore the inspiration.
When you have a survey which reveals that almost half of all teenagers in the United Kingdom have been bullied for the way they look, something needs to be done about this in every sense of the word. And accordingly, we're delighted to be able to welcome Lalaji Harries, Head of Wellbeing of Beat Bullying, and indeed Catherine Collins, Principal Dietitian at St George's Hospital at the NHS Trust. Lalaji, let's come to you first. This is quite a shocking statistic, actually, in terms of there's always been a certain tendency to pick on folk on the basis of how they look. But this is, you know, 48% is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's an incredibly high number. And I think when you stop and think about it, it's in a way not surprising that appearance is the first thing that people go for. It's the most direct way to isolate somebody and make them feel different. Okay. But it's also perhaps particularly troubling and difficult for young people whose body is changing throughout adolescence and childhood. Mm. And they may find that particularly difficult to deal with.
12 to 14-year-olds, more than 1 in 10 females say that they are permanently dieting. Again, we come back to this whole notion of body image, positive thing, the sense of well-being. Catherine, if we can bring you in on this particular one, how do we get the balance right between healthy mind, healthy body, not judging a book by its cover, but also making sure that we don't fall prey and that our youngsters don't fall prey to this notion of feeling they have to conform to a standardised image?
Well, I think as a parent and a dietitian as well, children don't tend to think about much about what parents think about their body shape and size. They're more concerned about what their peers think about them. And from the point of view of a teenager, the opinion of friends is twice as important as family opinion. So I think what we've got to do is that sort of stealth approach. We've got to try and make our teens mentally resilient and sort of stronger to the hurtful comments. And we've got to deal them effectively with body issues. So when you read the research about 1 in 10 young teenage girls are permanently on a diet, you've got to take that with a pinch of salt. They'll be trying to diet, they'll be cutting out foods, but then they'll be binging in the evening. So I think this research from Make Mind Milk and Beat Bullying shows that teens are keen to do something about their weight or their appearance, usually based on peer pressure, but we can do something about it.
The survey itself, once again, points out that girls seem to be more likely to be on the receiving end than boys. Obviously, let's hope we go for zero tolerance in both senses of the way, but is that, again, a kind of historical throwback, or are we still sort of in that sort of notion of the female perspective of looking to conform to image types?
Well, I think one of the key things about teenage girls is they look to role models, and the role models, unfortunately, tend to be models or actresses, wags and so on. And they actually, if they could see the sort of diet that those women actually have to follow to look like that, the amount of exercise they have to do. And in fact, I think, you know, even those, you know, the people to whom they aspire are actually very self-conscious and self-aware of their body image and how they look to the public. And I think we're very critical about female form in this country, and it's only when you get to adulthood that you eventually grow into your own skin and you feel, actually, you know, how I feel about myself is more important. I think there are certain issues that we can address, though. For example, with teenage girls that are overweight, and it's not just puppy fat, we don't want the binging diets, the cutting out of foods, the exclusion diets, the vegan diets. You can check out websites like Teen Weight Wise, which gives a lot of resources for teens about sensible, healthy eating, healthy snacking. And as parents, we can make sure that we can have foods in the house which are actually better for children. You're not the massive giant bags of crisps, but small portions, maybe having yogurts, having smaller packs of crisps, snacks that are less than 150 calories. Because teenagers do need fuel. They want to eat regularly. They're interested in how they appear, but they need some guidance as to what to do about it.
Lalaji, I'm fascinated by your line as an integrative counsellor for Head of Wellbeing of Beat Bullying. Presumably, again, cybermentor.org is a website you'd also recommend that would be worth pursuing if people are feeling stressed by this.
Well, yeah, our site is beatbullying.org.
Right.
And,
okay.
It's a very useful place to go to for support and advice from specially trained young people of the same age, and there's also always counsellors online. There's a lot of resources to help young people think about ways to deal with bullying, because one of the things we know is that bullying makes people feel very isolated. And another thing that the report highlighted is that often young people don't know what to do when they're bullied or when they see their friends being bullied. And beatbullying.org is a good place to start to find some answers and some support from other young people who've been trained to help you.
Is there light at the end of the tunnel? I mean, it seems as though this has been a story which has been running in for certainly 20, 30 years in many ways, and we've had, obviously, eating disorders, a whole variety of other bits and pieces. Catherine, do you see in your own professional work that there are signs that, at least in the Western world, we are beginning to address this?
I think there is. I think certainly for schools and bullying is a very powerful sort of message, you know, for people choosing schools for their teens, that, you know, bullying is not tolerated, there's zero tolerance. We've got the School Food Trust, and we're getting more and more involved in looking at training and teaching children about what is a healthy diet, giving them the grounded information which makes it easy for them to actually judge what is healthy eating. But there's always more to be done, and I think we have to target children and teenagers from their perspective. Having role models, for example, that eat a varied diet, that drink milk, that eat 5 a day fruit and veg, that don't binge diet, disagree with all the sort of bizarre diets out there, you know, sort of like the cod liver oil diet or whatever. And that's the way forward. It's actually getting really good role models, very powerful females especially, and I think the Olympics showed that last year, that you can be fit and healthy and vibrant without having to look skeletal and starving yourself. And I think gradually we're beginning to shift that emphasis, but what we need to do is give our teens that emotional support and that mental strength to actually deal with the issues they're facing.
Although, indeed, I'd certainly recommend that fish oils are very good for brain boosting in various ways from a nutritional supplement point of view.
Ooh,
but that's
no,
a whole different area.
That's not right, actually. Having fish as part of a healthy diet is, but fish oil supplements aren't.
Well, there we are. Interesting. There's a debate we could have on that one. Lanerji, same question for yourself again. Are we improving in this basis? Are we actually beating bullying?
I think there's a lot of positive steps being made. I think the fact that we're now talking about it much more, that it's a much more open topic in the media, can only be a positive thing, and I think that then throws some responsibility back on us to think about our own behaviour and our own the casual way that we talk around young people, what we model and what we put forward, how we make ourselves available as somebody that a young person might feel they can come to and say, I'm worried about my appearance, I'm worried that I'm being bullied. But yeah, there's certainly still a lot of work to be done.
There is a whole range of debates we could certainly follow through with respect to this, and perhaps we will in the near future. But for the moment, Lalaji Harries, Head of Wellbeing of Beat Bullying, and Catherine Collins, Principal Dietitian at St George's Hospital NHS Trust, many thanks indeed.
Thank you.
The finest in gourmet criticism and foodie delights, and the author of A History of Food in 100 Recipes. Quite clearly a question of quality personified. It's William Sitwell on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition.
It's always fascinating who we get as the warm-up act, the build-up act for William Sitwell. Obviously, in previous weeks, it's been Paul Daniels and Debbie McGee and so on. This time round, Lalaji Harries, Head of Wellbeing at Beat Bullying. I don't know, William. It's all much of us, but it's always nice to see the cream always rises to the top. How are you, sir?
There will never be a decent warm-up unless you manage to get my all-time hero, Jim Bowen, into your studio
as
the warm-up man for me. And
this is what you could have won.
This is what you could have won.
Yeah.
Exactly. In one, normal shirking, you'll love working with this fabulous power toolkit. Do you remember that? There was a great one where he went, it was Tony, went, in two, he was like, stay cool and upright like yours truly with a fabulous refrigerator. I like that one. That was good. It's poetry.
William, I see a whole new character, a whole new series coming out here. This is fantastic. It's genius stuff.
You know, you can watch Bullseye on Challenge these days.
Well,
my wife doesn't quite understand why I race to the telly to watch a Bullseye double bill on a Thursday evening. Yeah. But, you know,
it's there, and because it is there is probably sufficient answer. That's the important setup. Okay, quick introductions. Writer and broadcaster based in Lincolnshire, Alan Stennett, grandson of Herbert Stennett, and indeed author of Lincolnshire Lads on the Veldt, Alan Stennett. William Sitwell.
Very pleased to meet you on air, sir.
There we are, you see.
Likewise.
Because Alan is a very important part for BBC Lincolnshire, because you host which programme, Alan?
Lincolnshire Farming. Mm-hmm. Every Sunday morning, 7 o'clock. 94.9 FM.
Oh, steady on.
And also online. can compete with you all the way online.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, other stations are available. Is sufficient at this stage?
Sorry about that.
We could be fighting before the end of the day, William. Honestly.
I can never I can never understand a word these farmers say. You know, they're up far too early.
There you are. You know. It's very true. And, of course, Ed Wellman with us as well. So, William, you're back in the British Isles once more after your sojourn in France and in Portugal. Obviously, great connections from that line as well. How does it feel to be back in the smoke?
It feels very good. You know, I'm speaking to you as usual, well, as occasionally, from practically beneath the M40 in underneath the Westway in West London, where it's sunny, apparently, tragically, for the last time. I'm a bit worried about this. We have the Western and Weedon Horticultural Society's annual flower and food fair this Saturday in Northamptonshire. Nothing like, of course, like the sort of what you do in the Lincolnshire village in the summer. But, you know, the fact that if we have the heavens opening, it's going to be pretty depressing, but there's going to be pretty amazing vegetables there. But, yep, London is pretty sunny, fine and dandy.
I'm a little bit worried about, because, Ed, you said the same thing. You felt it's going to be the last thing. I said, that sounds like 1939 summer thereof, and then we actually go into all sorts of conflicts and conflagrations.
Sorry, but, William, I have heard the same thing, and I've read the same thing as well. So it must be true that, you know, summer ends here.
Yeah, well, we're off to the Burley Horse Trials.
In our wellies.
The Land Rover Burley Horse Trials, so it's going to be...
Don't have a Land Rover, though, sadly.
And talking about great sort of events, we've also got the fabulous North of England Horticultural Society Autumn Flower Show coming up next week. We'll be featuring Martin Fish, the show director there, because it's where, as I'm sure William will attest to, you can find some unfeasibly sized onions, amongst other things. Root vegetables. Alan, any questions for William about life, the universe? Because I'm supposed to say Jane Southall, Chief Executive Officer at the Lincolnshire Agricultural Society, very excited when I said that William is coming up to Lincoln to speak to the students first Monday in November.
That'll be excellent. We'll all be very interested to hear that. Do you have a particular topic for them, William, or is it open to questions from the students?
I'll do whatever I'm asked to do, as usual. I'll schlep up. Speak to the student, whoever it is, a couple of them I gather, and I mean maybe we'll talk. I think they may want to know a bit about journalism, how you can get into this business, and or I'll try and put as many of them off as possible. It's obviously a very crowded market.
Inject a little bit of realism
into the debate, and I'll speak to them about whatever they. You know, we could talk about food. We can talk about. Magazine, the art of magazine journalism. I can teach them how to write cover lines. I can tell them how to do a flat plan. You know, God, I mean, it's endless.
Precisely.
Possibilities. I ought to come along, because I mean, completely baffled by these kind of things. It's a different world than when I joined in the middle 1960s.
Well, indeed so. Yes, exactly. Life changes in every sense of the word. Ed, questions from yourself.
Yeah, William, I'm having a little bit of a kind of back to basics with my food habits at the moment. And I'm suddenly very tempted by the old traditional roast. You know, is this a good thing? What do you think about pubs that chuck out roasts all day?
Well, I don't know about pubs that chuck out roasts all day. I think that there's no greater thing than a roast meal done properly.
And your favourite would be if you had to sort of stand at the carvery and choose between pork, ham, or turkey. What would you do?
Oh. What about beef or lamb?
Well, what I like is a bit of beef on the bone so that you can turn it over, get some topside, a little bit of fillers underneath, the sort of stuff that you had to ask for behind the counter a few years ago during the BSE crisis. Oh. And that is my mother-in-law up in Scotland. There's a wonderful butcher in Melrose up on the Scottish borders who sells them the beef on the bone, and there's no greater cut, I think. It's fantastic. Just cook with a little bit of lard slowly in the agar, in the top right, pop down to the bottom for a bit, and then resting for a long time. There is, you know, a proper bit of probably Scottish beef. You know, I think the Aberdeen Angles or something. You know, there's no better. There's some very good beef farmers up in the Scottish borders.
I have to put in a bit for the Lincoln Red in there, I'm afraid. Rib actually, rather than the other. It's a bit of rib, I think, is my preference on that side.
Yeah, and but also, I mean, I would find it quite hard to live without roast chicken, and that would, I mean, you know, if you can get a proper good chicken. I was in, when I was in France the other day, the man who owned the little hotel we stayed in, he massages his chickens for an hour or so, and then between the skin and the flesh, he puts in marjoram and thyme, and then he roasts them slowly, and I think that's pretty pretty wonderful.
Oh, I thought you meant when they were alive.
Yes. No, yeah, whilst they're alive, that notion of sort of being a chicken masseuse, I think it's got possibilities.
Yeah. The key thing, of course, is to get your roast potatoes perfect.
And is it goose fat? Is that the thing to do with roasties?
No, I'd never. I always use olive oil because I think it can. You get a slightly higher temperature, so you can crisp them up a bit. And I tend to do them the day before and then finish them off for half an hour in the oven on at Le Moment Critique.
Again, looking to the local, what about rapeseed oil? A lot of people saying good quality rapeseed oil is as good as olive oil.
It is. I find personally that the flavour of it slightly permeates the meat in a way that I don't particularly like. I think it makes very good mayonnaise. There's a company called Farrington's in Northamptonshire who make very good rapeseed oil mayonnaise. And I think it's okay drizzled on a bit of salad. I personally wouldn't use it for roasting, but, you know. I wouldn't storm out of someone's kitchen if I saw them doing that.
And I'd have to put in a bit also, in talking about the roast, for a nice bit of rare breed pork roasted with good crackling on it. I think that's at the top of the list of all the roasts.
Well, there we have it. Suffice it to say, actually shifting from Jim Bowen impersonations through massaging chickens through to roast dinners, it's fantastic. Next week, William, I shall not be here. I'll actually be at an academic board doing a validation for a postgraduate aspect. But Ed Wellman will be. Now, the big question is, are you happy for Ed to actually do the dialing up stuff and connect with you at the similar sort of time?
Well, you know, I'll check the calendar and we'll see. I've got lunch with Lloyd Grossman that day, so maybe, you know, anything's possible in the morning.
You'll be Lloyd Grossman's warmer, perhaps.
William, you come here, do the show, I'll go to lunch with Lloyd Grossman. Sorted.
Suffice it to say, I take it you've had a reasonably interesting telephonic chat with us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Genius.
Yeah, well, there we are. And we'll hopefully be back next week with your good self, Ed. Splendid. So, as I said to Arthur McKenzie in the first part of the programme, there I was, sitting down to obviously ensure that Harrigan Policing His Way preview copy was actually sort of savoured in its fullest sense. Actually, its fullest sense should be in the cinema, quite rightly so. A premiere's coming up at the Durham Gala Cinema. And just midway through the whole programme, well, actually, just at the beginning of the programme, we suddenly go to the Osmonds on the soundtrack. I'm thinking, well, that Vince Woods must be a very talented soul to actually decide to pop that into the whole process. Vince Woods, director of Harrigan, and a whole heap of other goodies. Welcome to the Midweek Drive Morning Edition. How are you, sir?
Good morning to you. Thank you.
So, Crazy Horses and the Osmonds, Stephen Tomkinson, and Harrigan Policing His Way. Is there that sense of anticipation now as we approach the premiere where you actually think to yourself, I loved Hartlepool so much, I want to shoot every one of my movies there?
Well, it was extremely cold at the time, I can tell you. It was minus 15 when we were shooting some of the scenes in Hartlepool in the middle of the winter. So, quite a lot of the cast and crew do remember it for the cold, unfortunately. But I think it was like that across the UK, so I'm not singling out Hartlepool, I must say.
Yeah, I mean, surely for Stephen Tomkinson, it must have been just nip and tuck between Ballykiss Angel and Harrigan in terms of what you're channeling for there. Only kidding, Stephen. It's a different line.
Yeah, well, he's... he's a true professional. He's absolutely brilliant. He was lying on the tarmac of one of the roads. We had to do a few takes on that. And trust me, if you've got your head next to the tarmac, it's minus 15. That's hard work. Yeah, he earned his keep. That's for sure.
You've got a really talented cast, though. I mean, we asked Arthur in the early part of the programme, was it just an easy shorthand cliché to actually have a Cockney as the villain? And Arthur's response, well, no, he's a really good actor. That's why he had a Cockney actor and a whole thing. So that's great. But actually working together for a three-week shoot, 3 to 4 week shoot?
It was a four-week shoot, and then we did some other second unit stuff for a week as well. It's quite intense because there was varied locations. We had quite a lot of locations around Newcastle, Gateshead, around the Tyneside area, and obviously in Hartlepool. So when you're moving around a lot and resetting up in different locations, it's quite time-consuming moving people around. It's quite a demanding schedule, but that's the way everything is really nowadays.
Amongst the depression and fear growing in a crime-ridden sink estate in northern England, one man becomes involved in saving what little decency and community life exists. It's the winter of 1974. Power cuts and coal strikes cripple the country, which is reduced to a three-day working week alongside police centralisation. Everything, it seems, is falling apart, along with the community's only hope and protector, the nearly retired Detective Sergeant Barry Harrigan. I mean, there's got to be a sequel to this, surely. I mean, it's set up for a sequel, surely.
Well, everyone's talking about the sequel, but also a prequel as well. There's actually a backstory in Hong Kong, which is really interesting, and is based on the writer Arthur McKenzie's kind of things that happened in his life. I know that he's very careful what he can and can't say about what he did in Hong Kong, but he went to Hong Kong to fight police corruption within there, and there was, you know, connections with the triads, and, you know, he generally had a tattoo on his body so that he could get identified if, you know, he ended up in Tai Tam Reservoir in Hong Kong. So with his it was kind of that level. So all that is true about the tattoo.
You see, I asked Arthur a couple of times, Ed will attest to this. I said, Arthur, is it based on your biography? And you know, once we find out that actually Harrigan was a UK discus champion, I'll just say, aha, yeah, that's it, clearly, it's the key thing.
Yeah, I mean, it is an amalgamation, and we've put lots of elements, because I've known Arthur for a long time, and so we put in lots of elements and little stories about the incidents that, crime that he and characters they had to deal with over, you know, 3 decades in policing, and you kind of mush it all together and you create a kind of central theme, which was actually him reopening this section house or small police station, and that is where we based it around and started building the other characters and storylines around that. He the follow-on, we're talking about a TV series coming out of this as well. It's endless possibilities, really, but it's just such a rich vein of storytelling that it would be silly not to capitalise on that.
Very much so, and obviously a nod in the direction of Grant as well, who's sadly up in the great movie production Place of the Sky, who is responsible for setting the thing through. Okay, let's open it up a little bit. Ed, any questions for Vince about Harrigan and so on? I mean, that line about Arthur saying, well, 75% he felt was good. I thought, was there tension between Arthur and Vince? Surely not, you know? Anyway, carry on.
Vince, I'm very interested in what you just said then about the notions of prequels and sequels. Is that something that you're very conscious of when you're directing? Are you thinking, where might this go? Are you listening for ideas that people are coming up with?
Yeah, I mean, you have to take into account a lot of ideas, and, you know, you're working with a team, so you're trying to, you know, stick with the vision Arthur and I had originally and try and fulfill that vision within lots of ideas that are coming at you, but also the potential to create a sequel, the potential to create a prequel, keeping things also on budget and in on time. It's those are all the challenges that you have to deal with on a constant basis.
Yeah, and what's been one of the really, really enjoyable things about this particular project for you?
I think it's the variety. I mean, actually going out on location and meeting the people. It was, you know, it's a large cast, and it's really good fun to work with such a varied cast.
Alex has got the preview DVD on the desk now, but when can we...
I can't separate myself from it, actually, physically.
It's the
Harrigan policing his way. Splendid.
When can we likely to see this?
The premiere is on the 16th of September.
Right. I'm allowed to touch it. Look at this. I'm holding it now.
Steady, Ed.
Yeah.
And, be careful with it.
You know? Exactly.
And then it's out in the cinemas on the 20th of September, mainly across the north, but it's in View Cinemas, Showcase Cinemas, now in a few Odeons as well. But it's an independent release, so it's not like it's, we're not a Hollywood studio. So they don't just blanket every single cinema that, you know, exists in the UK. So there is a national release, but it's focused particularly in the northern area. But we'll take it further from there and see how it goes. But also they'll be out in DVDs in the shops in the first quarter. And then following that on TV and satellite.
Alan.
I love the idea of the link between Hong Kong, Hartlepool and Harrigan, which I think is splendid. But those middle 1970s you're talking about, I know that feeling because I was based down in Cardiff in South Wales at that sort of stage. It was a bad time for those. And just looking at your premiering at the Durham Gala, which was this sort of great celebration of the working North East and is now a sort of a rather nostalgic look back. Are people not going to see your film and think, oh, well, gosh, we're being reminded of these times gone by and we've lost all that kind of thing?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was a grim look back. You know, let's face it, it's not. There's no flowers and, you know, decoration in this movie. It was a hard time, and I think that's what we wanted to show, that there was another side to it. I mean, some people remember, you know, the three-day working week and, you know, communities coming together under hardship. But actually, you know, in a lot of the urban areas and the stories and the research that we did and what it was like for the police as well, because obviously they were huge cutbacks for the police force. A lot of the police stations were closed down and centralised into one place, that it was extremely tough. You know, if you were a single mum, in that time, and it was blackouts constantly, so you're walking, you know, it's constantly dark, you've got maybe a small family, your husband's left, and in those days as well, the research that we did, and I met people as well, you know, if they were still married, for example, a mum couldn't sign for her own rent with the council because she was still legally married, and the husband was the only person who could actually sign for the rent books, and so they were potentially going to get evicted because they were still married, and obviously the husband had, you know, gone walkabout. So those sort of situations, and you know, you're trying to, you know, heat your baby's milk, and you're reliant on electricity, and there's no electricity. You really felt sorry for a lot of people that were really under the cosh at that time, and it was quite a long period. I mean, it was nearly 3 months that the three-day working week was in place. So it was very challenging. So crime was going through the roof and total blackouts amongst the streets. It was extremely challenging for the police as well, knowing that they were literally the resources cut back. I mean, they had numerous pay freezes, and they didn't have the resources to deal with all the crime. So yeah, it was very challenging times, and I think people have to remember that. So they look back at it and think, yeah, it was a bit grim then, and actually it's not so bad now, even though we've had it quite tough recently.
I entirely agree with both of those points. It was rough at the time, and there are folk who are finding it pretty rough now. So, yeah, they'll perhaps appreciate it and sit through the film and think,
although it's fair to say, yes, language is a bit industrial, so if you have a bit of a problem with the Anglo-Saxonisms, etc., and effing and jeffing, you might need to be a bit sensitive. That's all I'll say. Just a little minor sort of one. Other than that, Vince, great movie and works well. I think we've got your next one, or one of several projects that could be developed. That's Alan's very own book, Lincolnshire Lads on the Veldt. A very brief description of Lincolnshire Lads on the Veldt, please, Alan, so that Vince can actually take it as a pitch, you know, and he can maybe sort of see their work through that. So go for it.
A description of the experience of two Lincolnshire farmer's sons who had probably never been more than 5 miles from their family home in flat Lincolnshire of fighting their way across South Africa during the Boer War in 1900 to 1903, something of that kind, and how they felt, what they were fed on, how they felt about the people they fought with. My grandfather would actually have liked to have gone back and lived in South Africa because he really had that respect for his enemy, but a very hard-fought war with all kinds of complications.
How does that grab you, Vince, as a pitch?
I like that. I like going back in time. I think it's nice to have... I do enjoy period pieces, and I think it's becoming more and more popular. It's actually also more cost-effective to do it nowadays as well, because of the developments and the advancements in CGI. So you can make it really authentic. And I love going into the detail of history and making it feel exactly as it should do. But also, stories can be told and in an environment, and people are more able... They kind of buy into it a lot more, I think, rather than running around a familiar place that they know is kind of current day. So I love all that stuff.
The contract is available whenever you like.
I was going to say, we might be at the birth of something wondrous here. It's fantastic. Vince, it's been fantastic connecting with your good self this morning. Don't forget,
Thank you. Of course, Harrigan
will be out very, very shortly. The premiere, of course, a couple of weeks' time at the Durham Gala Cinema. And then, of course, a general release. And keep watching out for that and go and get it and all the rest of bits and pieces. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic chat with us here on the Durham Gala today?
No, I love all this. I love talking about something, you know, I feel very passionate about. And it's a pleasure to work with people like Arthur. And, you know, we're working on other projects together and have been working on other projects in the past as well. And we're just pleased that, you know, the premiere's sold out and people are buying tickets.
Absolutely. Red carpet in Durham. There's an interesting thought. Never mind. It's to the whole range of things. Land of the Prince Bishop. So can we look forward, Vince, to actually connecting with you again in the very near future?
Yes, I'll be pleased to. I'm very pleased to.
Hurrah! A round of applause, please, Director of Harrigan, Vince Woods. Yes.
You. And you can pitch me more projects then, you see.
Yeah, well, you see, there we are. It'll happen.